A key component of the modern world economy, the chemical industry delivers products and innovations to enhance everyday life. It is also an industry in transformation, where chemical executives and workers are delivering growth and industry-changing advancements while responding to pressures from investors, regulators, and public opinion. Discover how leading companies are approaching these challenges here on The Chemical Show. Join Victoria Meyer, president of Progressio Global and host of The Chemical Show, as she speaks with executives across the industry and learns how they are leading their companies to grow, transform, and push industry boundaries on all frontiers. Here's your host, Victoria Meyer.
Hi, this is Victoria Meyer. Welcome back to The Chemical Show. So in today's episode, it's a bit of a unique episode. I recorded most of it at the WPC, World Petrochemical Conference 2024, which was held in Houston just a couple weeks ago. So as part of my intro, I'm just going to give you the three things that really were in focus for me during the conference, and I think for others as well. And number one is the energy transition and the critical role that chemicals has to play with the energy transition. The second piece is around supply chain. And 2024, much like 2021 and 2022, I think is the year of the supply chain, right? Since we've had some dramatic challenges with it so far already this year. And I have a great conversation that I had with Rahul Kapoor from S&P Global that you'll be hearing in a little bit. And then the third thing is that really this expectation of a future upside and upturn, probably not till the end of the decade. So don't be looking too closely for upside, because what we really know is that there's dramatic oversupply currently in many markets. So, you know, as a chemical industry leader, and I'm kind of drawing my conclusions first here this time, as a chemical industry leader, what can you do about this and with this? And when you listen to this episode and as you're thinking about it, what can you be doing? And so number one, I would say, first of all, is understand the role that you and your company play in the energy transition, whether it's providing products for new technologies, right? When I think about batteries and EVs and even solar panels and solar cells and a wide variety of things. There is no doubt that the energy transition is not possible without chemicals. So that's one piece. And then the second piece that goes with it is around, you know, reducing your footprint and your carbon footprint while still supporting growth. Maybe is a little easier said than done, but nonetheless, that's one of the considerations. The second piece is around building supply chain resilience. So we've been talking about this for a few weeks on and off here on The Chemical Show, and really for a couple of years, about the importance of supply chain resilience. This year's events, with crisis in the Red Sea and a crisis in Panama Canal, have created some dramatic challenges. What does that mean for you, and what do you need to be thinking about doing? Is number one, building optionality, right? So understanding your options and alternatives as it relates to your supply chain. And then number two, looking at alternatives, right? So alternatives in product, alternatives in supply points, alternatives in suppliers. Having a really robust strategy, and frankly, not just a strategy, an execution plan that's been tested and understood and is ready to go, is really critical. The third piece is preparing for a future upside. So there is investment underway, even though markets are long and they're going to be long for quite a while. However, as we all know, this industry is cyclical and markets will tighten up again. So preparing for that future upside with financial discipline. And in fact, one of the speakers on stage talked about the fact that the focus right now and for the next several years is truly financial discipline, particularly in Asia. It was a speaker from Asia who was referencing this, and financial discipline is really critical. And then practice playing a long and strategic game. So what I mean by that is really looking at today's markets and responding, but don't over-respond. However, understand the markets and the products where you are going to be winners and losers in the long term, and positioning yourself to move into those markets, finding opportunities to differentiate, right? And differentiation is key. What I think is interesting, you'll hear from me later, and this was a topic of conversation with folks when we were talking about like who's paying for it and how do we pay for quote unquote green chemicals, whether it be green ammonia, green hydrogen, other products. We, you know, talk a lot about green surfactants and bio-based surfactants. The reality is nobody really wants to pay more for what is effectively a drop-in replacement. So therefore, figuring out how to create meaningful differentiation, understanding your markets, understanding what you're bringing to the table, what your customers need, and differentiate. That's probably my number one message for you guys today. We're going to segue over to our on-site recordings. And let me know what you think about today's episode. And if you were at WPC, what you heard and saw and what your takeaways were. Would love to hear from you.
Hi, I'm recording today at the WPC World Petrochemical Conference 2024, which is sponsored by S&P Global. The theme of this year's conference is positioning for the next upturn. And it's actually been a really interesting mix of conversations, both on stage and off stage, about what that actually looks like, because there is a number of key themes around this, one of which, and in fact, this is the overarching theme, is that, yes, well, we're in a bit of a downturn at the moment, right? There's no doubt. Supply or demand is flat or appears to be relatively flat. We're in oversupply. Inflation has had an effect. What's going on in China has had an effect. Interest rates have had an effect. Yet the industry continues to be cyclical, and that we are clearly poised for an upturn. Maybe not this year or next year, but certainly when we think about by the end of the decade, there is an expectation of significant growth and investment restarting globally. So couple of big themes that we talked about here at the conference that I think are just worth sharing. Number one is decarbonization. In fact, I spent a lot of time this week in conversations around decarbonization, hearing from people on stage as well as off stage. And so what's really interesting is the onstage conversations for 80% of the time were basically that, hey, decarbonization is here. We need to get there. We need to be investing in hydrogen, we need to be reducing our greenhouse gas emissions, we need to be targeting 2050. And yet, aside from one bold panelist who talked about how we're paying for this, that was really primarily the sidebar conversation. Almost every break I was in after every panel or every discussion was decarbonization is great, but who's paying for it? The investment in hydrogen, ammonia, methanol as the future of the energy transition is expensive. It's expensive. It's costly. It requires a public and private partnership. And it's not yet clear, really, who's paying for it. Because, of course, there's a conundrum, and you guys know this, and I know this, and is that people want or think they want sustainable products. They want greener products. They want products with a lower carbon footprint. However, they need to be offering something more. Otherwise, they're not paying for them. And so this is a little bit of the dilemma I see, is that, you know, if we think about some of these products that are very much commoditized, let's take ammonia, for example. Ammonia is ammonia. Now, okay, somebody who's producing and selling ammonia, you might tell me differently, but the reality is it is very much a commodity product. And so there needs to be a bigger differentiator. People are not buying on product alone. What is the rest of your differentiation story? And that is something that, frankly, we did not talk about a lot here on stage, but I think it's something to talk about and we'll be continuing to talk about on the Chemical Show, because as you guys know, I like to talk about the customer experience, how you differentiate your business, and how you really create value. And you're not creating value by doing the same thing. You have to create value by understanding your customer's why, creating a differentiation, whether it be in product or in service or in offering or how you package it all together. And that is where the value comes in.
While we're talking about decarbonization, I'm going to bring in my discussion with Rahul Kapoor, who is the Global Head of Shipping Analytics and Research for S&P Global. He and I talked about the role of shipping, what some of the challenges are currently, and it's both a combination of decarbonization as well as just the fact of physical challenges in the Red Sea, Panama Canal, and elsewhere. Rahul brings in a perspective on shipping that I think you want to listen to.
I'm here with Rahul Kapoor from S&P Global today here at WPC 2024. And we're going to be just talking a few things about the shipping industry and what's going on there. So Rahul, thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Victoria. Good to be at WPC and welcome.
Thank you. So first of all, let's just talk about what's going on in shipping today.
Yeah, sure. I think if you look at the shipping industry, right, or rather the shipping markets, what we are seeing today is it's in the midst of what we call a geopolitical storm, right? If I take you back 3 years, it started with COVID. We had all those supply chain disruptions, massive ones at the end, right? So we had port blockages. We had all the stuff at the other end of the world, and we were waiting for all the shipments to arrive in the US and other markets, right? So we went through that, it normalized, freight rates corrected. Freight rates actually went to record highs. We were actually looking at $20,000 per TEU, and that had a major impact on many of the chemical companies, right? So the whole supply chains were disrupted. We went through that, then we had Russia, Ukraine, right? I think that led to many trade flow changes. When you look at the petchems, when you look at the oil markets and so on, so that had an impact as well. And just recently, back in November, we have this Red Sea crisis, right? So back-to-back, shipping has been facing some of these geopolitical crises. Just talking about the Red Sea, and if you want to go there, because that's a major disruption which you're seeing.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit more about the Red Sea, because obviously, you know, we thought things had normalized. Yeah. And then along comes the Red Sea crisis, which is a crisis, you know, not just for shipping. Mm. It's certainly a humanitarian crisis. Yeah. Yeah. And a crisis for the people in the region. But as we think about the relationship and what it means to chemical shipping, can you just share
sure,
more about
certainly.
That?
Certainly. I think there are two parts to it, right? So first of all, Red Sea or the Suez Canal is a key global artery for maritime trade, right? You can call it a super maritime highway. The 20,000 ships which pass through that, around 20-25% of the global container trade. Then you have almost 8 million barrels of products and crudes, including chemicals passing through it, both eastbound and northbound. And then you have LNG, LPG, right? So it's a major highway, maritime superhighway. What we have here is we have to understand that within the commercial shipping, there's a principle of freedom of safe navigation, right? That's being severely challenged. These are commercial ships which are passing through a narrow channel, and they become an easy target. The only time we've seen that is back in 1980s when we had the tanker wars, right? But otherwise, commercial shipping, despite the wars and all of that, continues to flow through. So essentially coming here is we've seen almost 80% of container trade which has been diverted, right? What that means is you're spending more time at sea, additional 2 weeks or so. That is higher inventory cost, right? We did hear about some of the European customers particularly suffering because of this higher inventory cost as well as most time at sea, right? So there is a bit of a disruption. The good thing was demand is soft, as we were talking earlier, right? So I think that has helped, and some of the capacity has been coming back. So overall, the impact on prices, freights are still higher, but they're not to the level of, it's not as bad as COVID. It is bad, but nothing comparable to what we had back then.
Right. So I think most chemical companies would not think that demand being soft is a good thing. But as you point out, in context of combining it with the shipping crisis, it certainly has eased some of the concerns and the height of what the disruption could really be.
That's correct.
Yeah. So let's talk about how these geopolitical challenges start factoring in. And there's a couple of things that when I talked with companies, we're talking about one of which is regionalization.
Yes.
And when we look at potentially shifting to more regional supply chains and in some ways regional independence of supply chains.
Yeah, certainly. I think if you go back and the global, if you say the global economy has benefited from globalization in that sense, or the world trade, right? Since China joined WTO, essentially we've seen a lot of increase in the global trade. Coming out of 2012-14, when we started seeing some of these companies as well as some of the policymakers talking about a bit of protectionism, right? We started seeing that some of the tariffs which came about. So the global trade still continues to grow, But COVID actually brought to the fore what we call supply chain resilience. And last year at WPC, we actually did that track was supply chain resilience. And this year we're doing decarbonization, right? Supply chain resilience is very important. And that was challenged massively in the COVID time. So there is a small effort towards what you would call a friendshoring, reassuring, right? Some of these. But China still stays at the center of the global factory of the world, right? It's a very long drawn process. We've seen some of that move to Vietnam, India, and so other places. But it's a very slow process, I would say.
Yeah, definitely. And one of the things I've seen and have heard is that there's some of this regionalization is kind of north-south. Instead of moving east-west, that we're going to see more north-south, which I also think ties into decarbonization. Indeed. Because when I think about supply chains and the effect that they have on emissions and certainly tier three emissions, which is due to the supply chain, it makes sense to have shorter supply chains.
Indeed.
So what do you see happening from that space?
No, that's one of the key topics which we are covering at WPC, right? I'm doing a track chairing essentially called Decarbonization of Supply Chains. The first session is about this chemical value chain and the second is about the transportation, right? It is at the core of what's going to happen over the next 15, 20, 30 years, right? If you look at particularly on the transport side, right? And we talked about Red Sea. Energy security essentially means that the ships which are rerouting now are emitting 3 times to 4 times more, right? So in the times of energy security, the sustainability goals take a hit because the ships have to reroute, they're speeding up, they're spending more time at sea and burning more fuel, right? But if you look at where we are coming from as well as what we look at, the supply chains, particularly on the transport side, are going from what you used to call a single bunker or for that matter, bottom of the barrel, heavy fuel oil, low sulfur fuel oil, to what we have today is ammonia, methanol, we're talking about hydrogen, carbon capture, right? It's a multi-fuel future, which is going to be costlier, right? So it will have an impact on the chemical value chain. It will have an impact on the global supply chains in terms of higher costs.
That's interesting. So one of the sessions I was in earlier today talked about how the costs will be coming down when we think about energy transition broadly, not specifically about the decarbonization of supply chains, but as these technologies get more robust, higher supply availability start coming down the cost curve. Should we expect to see that in decarbonization of supply chains?
We should expect to see that, but you have to take the cost up front. Right. So the challenge is the green methanol or green ammonia. Right. So those are very expensive today. The capacities have to come in and the industry, particularly on the supply chain side, is dealing from that chicken and egg situation. Right. Whether you will get that alternative fuel today or whether you'll get it 27 and 33. Right. So the capacities have to be set up. The initial cost is going to be higher. And as it works in the free market, all of that should settle down.
Yeah. Awesome. So if we think about just three trends that as it relates to shipping and decarbonization, what are the big three? What should we be looking for?
I think the first one would be supply chain resiliency. I think the three events which we've seen over the last, in a matter of 3 to 4 years, have shown you that supply chains being resilient is very important, right? So the companies are talking about that and we continue to talk about, right? You will see some of that diversification of supply chains, right? So the industry is very dependent on a certain regions in that sense. A bit of that coming back to, I would say, the Americas, a bit on the Europe side, that would be one. Second is everybody would take a part or stakeholders will be involved in decarbonization, right? So it's a process. We have to be patient, but it will take some time, but we'll get there.
Rahul, thank you for this.
Thank you, Victoria, for having me.
The second theme that's really come through is the need for alignment and collaboration. And this is really around standards, right? So at the moment, right, we know this, every country has its own set of standards as it relates to reporting, as it relates to sustainability and decarbonization, which those are key big themes that are driving us, but it also relates to products and how we sell and how we don't sell. And the industry groups have done a great job when we think about harmonization as it relates to chemical products. And I think about REACH as an example. While it started in Europe, it's certainly got global implications. And the industry groups have been very effective in driving standardization and alignment and creating a system that works across the industry and across the globe. Not true. Today, when we think about sustainability and ESG measurements, the targets that countries and companies are expecting us to hit Maureen Schroeder, who's managing director of Stolt Tankers, she expressed on stage, she said, I wish we could turn all of the people that we've got working on reporting and the complexities of reporting, because the reporting requirements are different in every single jurisdiction. If we could turn all of those people and that money, that investment into those people and their time and resources into innovation, into innovations to figure out how to become sustainable and decarbonized and developing the future platform for the industry, both from a product perspective, from a supply chain and logistics perspective, and more. And so that is, you know, a source of real frustration that I've certainly heard the theme coming through from stage is that currently we don't have a lot of great alignment on some of these standards across the globe, and we need to get there. The second piece that goes with that is really the request that we are less prescriptive in terms of how we get to carbon and greenhouse gas reductions, and instead of being prescriptive about the how, be prescriptive about the what, right? And so allow the chemical industry and the creative minds across the industry to identify the best and the optimal products and technologies and solutions to get us to a more circular, lower carbon, profitable world that we're all looking to grow and be part of. The third piece of that, and the third theme that really comes through throughout the conference, again, both from onstage and offstage, as I talk to people across the conference, is the fact that the chemical industry is a really vital part of the energy transition. In fact, I spoke with Tony Potter from S&P Global, and I'm going to include a clip with Tony, so stay tuned for that. But Tony talked about how we actually need more chemicals in a low-carbon energy transition world when we think about moving away from our traditional energy sources like oil and into energy sources like solar and wind and hydrogen. We need more chemical products. Hi, I'm here talking with Tony Potter, who is the head of chemicals for S&P Global. So, Tony, we seem to be living in a world of oversupply. That's certainly a concern when we talk to people. There's been a discussion around decarbonization and what it means for chemicals. And I think some people see the pros of it and others perhaps see the cons of it. But what do you see as the role of chemicals in the energy transition and in decarbonization?
Okay, well, thanks for the opportunity to talk with you. I think chemicals are absolutely essential in the path to decarbonization. We no longer just talk about the energy transition. We talk about an energy and materials transition. That's a reflection that to get to net zero, all materials of fabrication, of construction, need in themselves to decarbonize. Thermoplastics start off as a relatively low energy intensive product relative to iron, steel, aluminium, glass, whatever. Whilst the chemical industry needs to decarbonize its processes, chemicals and thermoplastics play a key role of that. And in most scenarios that we look at, we see people substituting these higher energy materials for plastic. You can't lightweight any form of transportation without plastic. No one's invented a paper car yet. You don't build wind turbines without plastic, and you don't build solar panels without plastic.
Yeah. That's a great perspective. And I think, you know, the general public doesn't understand much of that. Even I've had conversations recently in the recent past about, you know, fuel tanks, right? Fuel tanks today are all made out of plastics, which is why nobody has rusted out fuel tanks in their cars anymore. Whereas, you know, probably two decades ago, that was a major issue for, you know, especially if you were working on an old car.
Yeah. And of course, as we move to EVs, you don't need that fuel tank.
That is true.
But as we study the transition to EVs, maybe the composition of the plastics changes slightly. But net, we think that more plastic is used in an EV than in an ICE.
Yeah, that's right? really That's really interesting. There's a lot of conversation when I talk with people wondering about, are we ever going to reinvest in chemicals, right? So we feel that we're overbuilt, certainly in the commodity chemicals and in plastics. Operating rates are low. We've built for a world that's not this current cycle. Of course, we also know that our, you know, we tend to be very cyclical and we like to, in some cases, buy high and sell low, it seems like, when we're talking about investments in the chemical industry. Are we going to be investing again? What do you see?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's inevitable. Every cycle, someone says this is the end of cycles, and it never is. Look, this downturn will end at some point. It is a long, slow downturn. Something like ethylene operating rates are down to 80%. It's a long, slow haul back to reinvestment-type margins until capacity utilization tightens, you know, towards the end of the decade. But beyond that, look, we see a world where oil demand peaks around the end of the decade and then slowly starts to go into decline. We see no such peak for petrochemicals. We're doing forecasts out more than 30 years. We've never found anything that we could describe as peak polymer. Petrochemical demand will keep on growing as long as the population grows and as long as the wealth of that population grows.
That seems a little bit contrarian. I mean, I agree with you on the fact that we all seem to like to use plastics, and yet there are so many, you know, I think about the plastics treaty, which was really around, it went from, in fact, we heard Jim Fitterling talk this morning about it going from being about reducing plastics pollution to reducing plastic, and now we're back to reducing plastics pollution. I think there's some people that would say that's a bit, that this continued growth pattern maybe cannot continue.
Cannot, but what do you grow with if you don't grow with plastic? Okay. So there's no doubt the world has a plastic waste problem and it needs dealing with, and legislation is likely to be passed to deal with that, whether it's international treaty or individual governments. Plastic in the wrong places is a problem. There's no doubt that as part of the energy and materials transition, we need to build a more circular economy, and plastics recycle is part of that. But at the moment, if I take polyethylene as an example, probably 7 or 8% of polyethylene globally is mechanically recycled. Okay, we see that number almost tripling in the next 10 years, but the underlying demand growth for polyethylene is still such that we see virgin polymer demand continuing to grow. And one of the issues is actually building out the supply chain to collect, to sort, to clean waste, which in itself is carbon intensive. You know, unless you build a green supply chain, there's actually a danger you expend more carbon than you save.
Right, because it is intensive to get the recycling and the mechanical piece of it. It doesn't exist in many places, and even where it does, it's not always fully utilized, right? I certainly know that in my own community, many people don't recycle, even though we have curbside recycling, right? And
in the US, there are over 80 different types of legislation, not even consistent at the state level, but from municipality to municipality, what can and can't be recycled. It's crazy.
It's complicated. Yeah. It's very complicated. Well, Tony, thank you for joining us. I appreciate your perspective.
You're welcome.
So that's one factor of it. And just the continued evolution of products, innovation, lifestyles, et cetera. So I think, you know, there's no doubt that, and this was a theme that came through, is that the energy transition and the chemical industry are clearly hooked together. And we're going to be seeing more of that. So I think there's an opportunity for innovation. We heard from a number of people on stage, Karen McKee from ExxonMobil, others, about the innovation that's going to be coming through from the industry in order to enable the energy transition. So to sum it up, I would say, you know, the pulse and the theme of the week is the future is bright. There is an upturn. There is a lot of positivity. There is a concern about how are we paying for it and who is paying for it. And our experts in the industry, scientists, engineers, technologists, to really develop optimal solutions for us, for the world, as it relates to energy, greenhouse gas emissions reductions, et cetera. And clearly a theme of who's paying for it, right? So I think everyone is clear that the economics have to work. And that's maybe a big shift. The fact that we actually need to have we're shifting to where this has to make economic sense. It just can't make theoretical sense. Sustainability, our reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by 2050 makes perfect sense in theory. However, it also has to make economic sense for companies, for governments, for individuals, in order to support the drive where we're going. So anyway, that's my summary from WPC 2024. I hope you've enjoyed it. If you attended, send me a note. Let me know what you heard, what other themes came through for you, and I'd love for you to share that with me. Thanks.
We've come to the end of today's podcast. We hope you enjoyed your time with us and want to learn more. Simply visit thechemicalshow.com for additional information and helpful resources. Join us again next time here on The Chemical Show with Victoria Meyer.